Chapter 2, One Nation Under God, A 50s Boyhood. I had a sort of typical American boyhood for the 1950s. A lot of sports, a lot of good times, and bad, with my sisters, and a lot of cutting up in school. But that doesn't mean it was idyllic or somehow cut off from the world. There was the pervasive gender conditioning, and there were ways in which the big issues of the grown-up world, segregation, McCarthyism, and conformism, were expressing themselves even in my boyhood. We moved to Berkeley when I was 3, and I have a few very sharp memories and some impressions from those days. I remember when I was told there was no Santa Claus, when I was 5 years old. We used to have Christmas presents on Christmas Eve, and my father or one of my uncles would dress up as Santa Claus. After you get to be a little bit more of a thinking person, you realize that there's always someone missing every Christmas Eve when you're passing out presents. So this Christmas Eve, after Santa came and we passed around and opened up our presents, as I was going to bed, my parents came into my room and told me, "I guess you've already figured this out, but you know there isn't really a Santa Claus." And I said, "Yeah, I kind of figured that out." I remember that this led to some tension with some of the other kids in kindergarten, because of course when you're a kid that age, you may not have that much awareness of or respect for how other kids' families are handling this. So you just start saying, "Oh, there's no Santa Claus." But some of the kids still believe there was. To give you a sense of the kind of little kid I was, one time I got the idea that instead of going to school, it would be fun to go off and do something else. And another kid and I just completely disappeared and never showed up for school. My parents were panicking, and in particular my mom was trying to find me. And eventually they found us somewhere. We just thought it would be fun to go off and do something else that day. Another time, some teenager in the area was trying to get me to jump out of a second-story window, promising to catch me. I was just about ready to do it, but my mother came along and just caught it in the nick of time. She stopped me just as I was swinging my legs over the window sill. She was furious. I remember little things like that, crazy things that happen, but you somehow survive. Or usually people survive them. Sports. Sports has been a big part of my life since I was very, very young. I think I started playing football and basketball and baseball when I was about 5. True to his word when he had polio, my dad took me out and taught me how to play all these things. It was a very important part of his life. He loved sports, and he wanted me in particular to take this up. There was a whole thing about being the boy in the family at that time, frankly. It's not like my sisters were explicitly excluded from this, but this was more of a thing with me, being the boy. My dad started taking me to football games and basketball games from the time I was about 4 or 5 years old. I remember every year there'd be a parade through downtown Berkeley before the start of the football season, and this was one of the highlights of my year. The parade made it almost tolerable to have to go back to school. Our elementary school was small, but we did have organized teams in baseball, basketball, and football. We played other schools and had city championships. We even had a young kids team for first and second graders, and I played on that when I was 6 and 7. Whenever he could take off from work, my dad would always come to my games from the time I was really little. You'd always see him with his little 8mm camera taking pictures on the sidelines. When I got a little older and I'd throw a pass that was a pretty long pass for a 5th or 6th grader, you'd see my dad pacing down the sidelines, trying to measure how many yards long the pass was. He'd say, 33 yards. That was a 33-yard pass for a touchdown. So he gave me a lot of encouragement. My dad had this friend. I think he was a lawyer who worked with him as a government lawyer when we were back in D.C. And my dad used to write to him all the time in these deliberately exaggerated terms, bragging about my sports exploits. He'd write about it as though it were professional teams playing, sort of in a self-consciously exaggerated way. And then his friend would write back. In her own way, my mom also shared in my enthusiasm for sports. But my dad in particular was just full of passion for it, and he had a lot of pride in whatever I was doing. But it wasn't that sort of disgusting thing where you put pressure on your kid and you have no appreciation for other kids. He wouldn't yell at me when things didn't go well, and when we lost the city elementary school championship game in football, my parents consoled me. They didn't act like I'd let them down. It was never that kind of thing. I just loved sports, and whenever I got a chance, I tried to play. I didn't care if the other kids playing were a lot older than me. So from a very early age, around 5 or so, I started hanging around kids who were older playing sports, even young teenagers or 10 or 11-year-old guys. And of course, one of the big things when you get into sports, in this kind of society, is that there's this whole macho element to it. And one part of that is you swear a lot. So one day, we were just playing catch with the family, and I think I dropped a ball or something, and I said, "Oh, shit!" Now, my parents came from the kind of background where you didn't say things like that, especially in public. They didn't get too angry, but they told me that what I had said wasn't a very good thing to say, and I shouldn't do that. So after a little while, I looked up at them and said, "Well, okay then, but is it all right to say, hubba hubba?" Which was another thing I'd heard hanging around the older kids playing sports. So as a young boy, I was just football, basketball, baseball all year round. From September until the end of November, it was football. Then from December until the spring, it was basketball. Then in the spring through the summer, it was baseball. My life was kind of seasonal in that kind of way. And I loved all those sports in their turn, in their season. When I was 6, we moved into a new house. And it was about equidistant between two schools that were in the Berkeley Hills. One of them was called Cragmont, and the other one was called Oxford. I remember my parents telling me, "You can go to either school you want. We'll let you choose." I said, "Okay, but I want to look at them." So my dad drove me around and we looked at both schools. And I picked Oxford, because when we drove by it, I could see the basketball courts on the playground. I was lucky enough to have a good coach when I was coming up. He was a student at Cal and took care of the playground in summer and on the weekends and after school. But he was also the coach of our teams. I remember him fairly fondly. He was a nice guy, not like a military drill sergeant. To give you the contrast between him and some of what you often see, we had an incident when I was in fourth grade where we were behind by a couple of points in a football game, and on the last play of the game, I threw a pass for a touchdown, and we won the game. Or so we thought. Nobody had showed up to referee the game, so the coach of the other team was refereeing, and his own team was offsides on this play. He called offside on them and then came running up to the kid who was the captain of our team for that day and said, "They were offside. They were offside. You want to take it? You want to take it?" And the poor kid got confused, not knowing what it was. He was thinking this coach ref was talking about the touchdown, so he said, "Okay, we'll take it." And then this coach ref insisted that it meant the offside penalty, so we were forced to run the play over again. We ran the play again. I threw the pass again, but this time it was incomplete, and we lost the game. That coach referee should not have put that kind of pressure on an 11-year-old kid. He should not have tricked him in that way. There should not have been that kind of atmosphere where winning was that important. Our coach was not like that. He was actually a fairly decent guy, as I remember, and it didn't make us feel like we failed the universe or him if we didn't win a game or even a championship game. But from the time I was 9 or 10, I was pretty regularly playing sports with teenage kids. And they inculcated in me the idea that you had to win, you had to win, you had to win, and that losing was a disgrace. They had had this drummed into them, and it's not so much that they sat me down and said, "This is the way it is," but it just kind of rubbed off on me, along with a lot of macho stuff and the bullshit that boys in general absorb in this kind of culture. It was generally very pronounced in the 50s, but especially boys who were deeply into sports got a heavy dose of this. Those are the kind of things that come from hanging around with older kids playing sports. That was kind of the negative side of it. There were a lot of positive things that came out of it because of the particular times and because of the opportunities that it presented to have a lot of experience with kids from completely different backgrounds and situations, particularly black kids. That was very positive. At the same time, there was this negative side, the sort of macho, militaristic, win-at-any-cost kind of stuff. But I didn't get that from my own coach in grammar school, and I didn't get it from my parents. My sisters. Overall, I got along well with both of my sisters. But it was kind of a classical situation where my sisters had to do things like iron clothes. They even had to iron my clothes. When I got into high school, I had friends who were from poorer backgrounds who ironed their own clothes. But my sisters had to do all the stuff like ironing the clothes, even my clothes. There were all those domestic things they had to do. Well, I didn't have to do too much of that. And generally, I didn't have to do as many chores as they did. I can even remember at one time I had forgotten this, but my younger sister reminded me of it, that when I got to be driving age and got my license, my parents would let me use one of their two cars, and I would drive all over. But when Mary Lou came along later and wanted to use the car, my attitude at the time was, "What do you need the car for? You're a girl. I need the car." So there was tension that resulted not just from being siblings, but also from the sort of gender socialization and male domination which I just grew up with. Even though I love my sister, I just assumed that driving a car is what a guy does. A girl gets a guy to drive her around in a car. Girls don't drive cars. That's how I saw it then. But even earlier, there was tension just because I was always kind of a prankster. For example, my father would quite often at dinner time say, "Okay, gang," and then he'd start telling us about the latest case he was involved in as a lawyer. And so we got a lot of that training. All of us got it, but one of the ways in which I used it, because again, I was always sort of a prankster, was just for the nasty fun of it, I'd get Mary Lou, who had her favorite toys, to sign contracts that would turn over these toys and the ownership of these toys to me. Not because I wanted them, but just to trick her. She would naively sign these contracts, trusting me, and then I would say, "Okay, now give me this toy or that toy." She'd say, "No, that's my toy." And I'd reply, "Yeah, but you just signed it over to me." Then she'd go running, crying to my dad, who would then come down and look at the contract and invalidate it as having been achieved under fraudulent circumstances. Now, Mary Lou and I were very close in a lot of ways, so I don't want to give a one-sided impression, but these were pranks I liked to play, and then my dad would have to come down and invalidate them, and all my hard-earned trickery would be undone. We used to play around the house together a lot. From the time I was about 9 until into high school, I had this recurring Sunday night sickness. That is, when Sunday nights came around, I would not want to go to school the next day, so I would start calculatingly coughing about 8 o'clock at night on Sunday. And after I went to bed, I'd wake myself up and have these coughing spells in the middle of the night. Then I'd wake up again at 5 or 6 in the morning and really start coughing. And after a little while, my mother and my father would come and say, "Oh, you've been coughing all night." And I'd answer, "Yeah, I really don't feel well. I think I'm sick." Then there would be this little dialogue. "Well, do you think you're well enough to go to school? All you care about is whether I go to school or not. You don't care about whether I'm sick." So then I would get to stay home. When my younger sister got a little older, I tried to get her to do the same thing. And sometimes she would, and we had all kinds of games. We had a rollaway bed on wheels, and I used to tie a rope to the rollaway bed and tie the other end to a door handle, and we would pull ourselves around and get rides on it and things like that. Or we'd make a fort using blankets, bed covers. I also remember when I was about 6, I guess, the big star football player at Cal was a guy named Jackie Jensen. So my dad and I were always playing catch and talking about Jackie Jensen. I remember Mary Lou, she was just 3, picked up a football and ran around the backyard saying, "Me Jackie Jensen, me Jackie Jensen," because she was trying to get in on things too. She didn't want to be left out. My older sister Marjorie would be in charge of us when my parents would go out sometimes. So then there would be conflict between my older sister and the 2 others of us, and we'd get into a lot of fracases. But while I'm talking about a lot of the conflicts we had, we were also really good friends. We would confide in each other a lot, the way kids do, and conspire against our parents, or complain about our parents, about what they wouldn't let us do, or what they made us do. I remember one time my parents went on a trip for a week, and they left us in the charge of this college student who was a friend of the family's. He, of course, didn't know anything about how to raise kids anyway, and he particularly didn't know how to deal with us. And so we had all these grievances that accumulated against this guy, who we thought was a tyrant. We would get together and conspire against him and try to give him a hard time because we thought he was just absolutely unbearable. Of course, he was actually in an impossible position. But I remember we'd do a lot of conspiring together like that, or just getting together and talking about things, the way kids do. So I was actually very close to my sisters. There was the usual tension between siblings, and then there was the tension that came from the larger societal roles that expressed themselves within our family. But within all that, we were still very good friends and very close. Still, the gender conditioning went on from an early age and was pervasive. I would interact with girls in school. Sometimes maybe we'd work on projects together. But as far as things you would do outside of school, at recess or during your own time, the girls pretty much played with the girls and the boys with the boys. There were the usual grammar school flirtations that went on, but friendships were not really developed that much across gender lines. With my sisters, it was again a contradictory thing. I really loved my sisters a lot. We were very close in a lot of ways, and I did some things with them. In some ways, I was the good big brother, and in some ways, I was the jerk big brother, or little brother, depending on which sister it was. But they would go to dance rather than sports, or they were Girl Scouts or Campfire Girls while I was in the Cub Scouts. I didn't go on to join the Boy Scouts, because it took too much time away from sports. We were in different worlds a lot. When we got older, when we started really getting interested in the opposite sex, we'd talk about that with each other and get advice. So it was kind of contradictory like that. Our worlds overlapped, especially in the family context, but they were also very different. And again, this took place in a whole societal context. For instance, there were all kinds of ads on TV at that point. And in retrospect, you see that in addition to the products, they were selling ideology too. You had Lorraine Day, for instance, who was a spokesperson for Amana, which is a religious group that financed themselves through making household appliances. Lorraine Day was like an institution herself. She'd demonstrate a refrigerator and show you what a great freezer compartment it had, and so on. The Lorraine Day thing was directed toward women as housewives, all the latest appliances that they needed to have. Although my mother was cast somewhat in the role of the classical wife and mother at that time, there was a lot more to her than that. She went back to teaching when we kids got a little older. She did a lot of substitute teaching, and sometimes her assignments turned into long-term substitute teaching. A lot of the dinner table conversation was dominated by my father, talking about his legal cases. But she would join in that, and she would also talk about other things, and not just waxy buildup on the floor. School. My whole neighborhood, the grammar school I went to, pretty much my entire universe, was very monochromatic, almost entirely white. There were a few Asian kids, and in the sports that I watched, things were changing. So if you include those kind of influences, the world I live in was not entirely white. But the immediate neighborhood and the school I went to were just about entirely white. And so were the teachers and the principals and all that. I liked school all right, but to be honest, if someone asked me what was your favorite part of school when you were a kid, I'd have to say recess, when we could go out and play. It's not like I never enjoyed anything in the classroom, but a lot of it, frankly, wasn't that interesting. Even for that time, a lot of my teachers seemed like fuddy-duddies, old-fashioned, strict, kind of narrow-minded people. And this was from the time I started first grade, back in 1949. I remember when I started first grade, we had the alphabet up on a poster on the wall of the classroom, and we were supposed to learn how to write the alphabet. A lot of it was very uninspiring. You learned how to print the letters and how to write in script, which is necessary, but you can only do that for so many times until it starts getting to be a bit boring. And we literally read those books with Dick and Jane and their dog Spot. See Spot Run. Mainly a lot of what I learned, even reading, was from reading the sports page. From the time I was very young, I used to read the box scores of the baseball games and the results of the football and basketball games. I remember even before that, around the time I was just starting first grade, a friend of my father's was visiting, and my dad started bragging about what a bright kid I was or something. And so the guy asked me, "Okay, how do you spell cat?" And I said, "I don't know." I don't remember if I really didn't know, or if I just didn't feel like going along with this. But then my dad said, "Just wait a minute, wait a minute. Tell him what's 7 times 7. And I answered, "I don't know 7 times 7. My dad answered, "Sure you do. What's 7 touchdowns all converted?" And I immediately replied, "Oh, 49. That's a lot of how I learned as a young kid. When I got a little older, maybe in second, third grade, I started reading other things, like the Hardy Boys mystery stories. But the way I got my introduction to arithmetic and reading was through the sports pages. Just to give an example of how mechanical teaching was, in California at that time you could start school not only in September, but also in February. Then your school year would run from February to February, and you'd graduate in February rather than in June. So because of that, and because the school I went to was small, when I went into the fourth grade, there were also the kids who'd been in the fourth grade for a half year already, who were in the same class. And I remember this fourth grade teacher had all the kids write the multiplication tables on cards. Then she'd call on someone and they'd have to stand up and the teacher would say, "Jenny, do your sixes." And Jenny would get up and go, 6 times 1 is 6, 6 times 2 is 12, 6 times 3 is 18, like that. I was just about 1 week in this class, having come in at the midterm, and I already knew my multiplication tables. But I didn't know that you were supposed to have cards with these tables written down on them. A little later, my turn came. The teacher called on me and said, "Do your eights." In anticipation of this, I had taken a piece of paper and just scribbled some things on it and folded it up so it looked like I had my multiplication tables written on it. I got up and I looked at this card that just had scribble on it, and I went, 8 times 1 is 8, 8 times 2 is 16, 8 times 3 is 24, 8 times 4 is 32, 8 times 5 is 40, and so on. The teacher nodded approvingly, and I sat down with a great sigh of relief. But this girl sitting behind me raised her hand and said, "Mrs. So-and-so, he wasn't really reading from a card. He didn't have anything written on his card at all." But the teacher couldn't really do anything, because after all, I had gotten them right. Still, you can see how mechanical the whole approach was. By the time I got into junior high, and even before that, I was notorious for playing pranks in school, and I drove a lot of teachers crazy, including maybe some who didn't deserve it. Nonetheless, my friends and I were always playing jokes on each other and pulling other pranks, disrupting the classroom, like doing something, then making the teacher think it was the other one who did it. I got sent down to the principal's office fairly often. And fairly often I would hear this lecture about how I came from a good family and I was a good student. So why was I so ill-behaved? Froggy the Gremlin. We got a television when I was fairly young. Saturday mornings I used to like to watch the Andy Devine Show, brought to you by Buster Brown Shoes. Andy Devine was this old, somewhat over-the-hill actor, and he had this kids show. They used to advertise Buster Brown Shoes and some other things. But the main thing I remember about it was a puppet named Froggy the Gremlin. The highlight of that show was when Andy Devine would say to the audience, "Okay, kids, it's time now." And all the kids would get excited and start cheering because they knew what was coming. Then he'd say, "Okay, pluck your magic twanger, Froggy." And there'd be this little puff of smoke, and then this little miniature puppet of a frog would appear. Boing, boing, boing. He had this low-pitched sort of frog voice, and he'd go, "Hiya, kids, hiya, hiya, hiya." And the kids would come back in their high-pitched voices, "Hi, Froggy." Froggy was an imp, and they'd bring on guests who were shills for him. There would be Mrs. Pillsbury, say, who'd give a lecture about how to bake cookies. She'd go, "Now, kids, you take the flour and you put it in a bowl, and then you put in some eggs and milk, and you stir it up, and..." Then Froggy the Gremlin would say, in this low, insinuating, mischievous voice, "And you pour it on your head." Then Mrs. Pillsbury would say, "That's right, you pour it on your head." And she'd pour it all over her head. Then when she'd realize what she'd done, she'd yell, "Oh, Froggy!" And he'd go, "Ha, ha, 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 ha." You had to be there as a 9-year-old kid at the time, I guess. But to me, it was hilarious. I look forward to that every Saturday morning. Every kid, at least the ones I knew, wanted to be like Froggy the Gremlin. But I think I actually carried that more into practice than some other kids. When I got into junior high school, I developed this unique voice of my own, which was kind of like the Froggy the Gremlin voice, but a little different. And I would cut up in class and disrupt the class in this voice whenever the teacher would turn his or her back. Then I taught a friend of mine to do the voice. At one point, we were taking a test, and he did that voice. He was sitting 2 seats behind me in the same row, and ironically, the teacher made me stay after school in detention because she was convinced that only I could do this and no one else. I tried to just tell her I didn't do it. I wasn't going to rat out my friend, but I kept insisting, "I didn't do it. I didn't do it. Somebody else did it." She wouldn't believe me, of course, but I got a lot of inspiration from Froggy the Gremlin. One Nation Under God. Since my father was religious and my mother was very religious, Sunday school and church were required. There might be certain special events we could miss it for, but generally we had to go to Sunday school, or at least to church on Sundays. To me, it was another occasion where you would have friends and you'd see other kids. We'd kind of cut up in Sunday school the way we did in regular school, but going to church was another matter. My mother was really into music, and she'd given us a lot of that love for music. So some of the hymns I didn't actually mind singing, even as a kid. But listening to the prayers and then sitting through the sermon was just something you did until you could get out of there and go enjoy the rest of your Sunday before you had to go back to school the next day. It's not that I wasn't religious or didn't believe in those things. I more or less did. I'd never really been challenged on that or challenged it myself. I believed in it because that's the way I'd been raised. But on the other hand, I wasn't the kind of person who looked forward to going to church or Sunday school or wanted to sit in church all day. A lot of times we'd go out to eat Sunday dinner after church. So I remember sitting in church thinking about the shrimp cocktail I'd be eating when the church service got over, or how I was going to be able to go home and watch some sports with my friends in the afternoon, or just go out and play. I didn't know anybody who was an atheist or who openly expressed even agnostic views. Those were times when if you were in the United States, in the middle class and white, then you went to church, and that's just the way it was. I know that there were exceptions to that, but in the world that I was in, and overwhelmingly among that section of the people, that's the way it was. And you weren't really encountering a lot of people who questioned it. I did in high school, especially, and maybe a little bit beginning in junior high. In high school, given the nature of the high school I went to, Berkeley High, there were a lot of people whose parents were intellectuals and academics, and they were agnostics or even outright atheists, and some were even communists, I now realize more fully than I did then. But that was more in high school, and mainly in the social setting of my childhood, people were just religious. When I was 13 or 14, my father took me on a trip to L.A. One day he had to go off to a meeting or something, so I went downtown to an area modeled after Hyde Park in London. I think they even called it Hyde Park. People gathered around giving talks up on little soapboxes. Anybody could get up and talk, and some people were giving talks refuting the existence of God and putting forward atheism. I think that's the first time I heard somebody put forward a coherent atheist position publicly like that. And even though the people were adults, I got up and argued in refutation, or attempted refutation, of their atheism. That's one of the first public speeches I remember giving. I wasn't one of these religious fundamentalist reactionaries, but I was raised to be fairly strongly and fervently religious. And while it wasn't a big deal to me on a day-to-day basis, when it was hit at, I would hit back, because the things I'd been raised to believe deeply were being hit at, and this was like hitting me. One time when I was about 12, I met a Jewish kid while I was taking swimming classes. This is the first time I talked with a Jewish person about what we believed and didn't believe. And I remember saying very ingenuously, naively, and not with any malice, but just being shocked when it finally dawned on me as he was telling me what he believed, "You mean you don't believe in Jesus Christ?" He very calmly and patiently explained to me that he didn't and why. That was a shock to me. That was the first time that I'd heard someone put forward, face-to-face in a personal conversation, that they didn't believe in the Christian religion that I'd been raised with. I wasn't outraged, I was just taken aback. I just sort of didn't believe it. In elementary school, we used to say the Pledge of Allegiance, and I didn't question it. I actually remember when I was something like 9 or 10 years old, literally thinking to myself, I didn't physically do it, but I thought it, that I should get down on my knees and thank God for living in this great country that we live in. And I should be grateful that I don't live in one of those awful countries that so many people seem to have had the misfortune to be born in. This is literally what I was saying to myself. And talk about being religious. I remember I used to tempt God. I would say things like, "fuck," to myself to see what God would do. Then I'd pray for forgiveness because I'd said something awful. But I couldn't resist doing it again. A few minutes later, or the next day, I'd say, "shit," because I'd already heard all these words from the older kids I was playing sports with. So yes, it was very patriotic, very straight-laced. It was middle-class America in the 50s. It went along with the whole anti-communist thing, the drills to duck under your desk to save you from a nuclear bomb, to get people into the psychology of maybe we're going to have a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. Though I don't know how ducking under a desk was going to save you from a nuclear bomb. Traffic boy. We not only had the whole usual patriotic drill, but we literally were drilled in the 4th, 5th, and 6th grades as traffic boys. We didn't have adult traffic guards at Oxford Elementary School. It was the kids themselves, the boys again, who were organized into squads who would go to school early and go out before school, then at the beginning of lunch, at the end of lunch, and at the end of school, when kids might be coming or going. We would go and actually perform these duties, stopping traffic. In our school, this was very serious. We had a cop who came from the Berkeley Police Force who was assigned to train us. We had this whole routine where we had the traffic signs we'd hold, and we had whistles. You were supposed to march out when the whistle blew and stand at attention. And you'd hold your sign out to the front and side. And when the whistle blew again, you'd twirl your sign and pull it back in, then march back to the sidewalk. They used to have parents' nights when we'd go through these marching formations. Oh, we wore uniforms and caps, and we'd go through these marching routines. I remember that when I was in the fourth grade, they had a drilling contest. There were maybe 40 traffic boys. The cop would put us through our paces. Left face, right face, forward march, attention, about face, to the right march. And if you did the wrong command or if you didn't do it at the right time, then you got eliminated. That time it got down to the three of us. I was so proud because my parents were there and I was in the fourth grade, first year as a traffic boy, and I'd hung in there all the way to the end, me and two upper class guys, fifth and sixth graders. Then the cop ran all these commands on us, trying to get one of us to mess up so he could finish the thing. And we all kept doing it right. So then finally he eliminated me because even though I was standing at attention the way I was supposed to, he said my feet weren't quite together the way they were supposed to be. I was determined to win this contest as a fourth grader because that would have really been a big deal. So I was bitterly disappointed. This is the kind of stuff you get indoctrinated with. Then there was what they call the top sergeant, the head traffic boy, who ran all the squads of traffic boys, under the direction of the school officials, of course. It was always a sixth grader. The boys in the fifth grade would vote for who should be the top sergeant the next year. I remember one time that the kid who was voted to be the top sergeant had to be put through the paces before they would officially allow him to be it. So during school, we all got on our uniforms, and we went out in the yard, and the cop who was assigned to us from the Berkeley police was there. And then he turned us over to the kid who was supposed to be top sergeant. This kid was marching us around and doing pretty well. And then all of a sudden, a girl came down from the principal's office to tell this kid who was going to be the top sergeant that his mother was very sick. Now, he was an 11-year-old kid, so he just took off running to the principal's office to find out more about his mom. And they reprimanded him severely because he hadn't put his troops in proper order before he'd gone running off. And his mother wasn't even sick. They lied to him. That was really the sick thing. They lied to this kid to see how he would react under pressure. An 11-year-old kid. I reflected on that a lot of times, how similar it is to the bourgeois military. The principal, this cop from the Berkeley Police Force, and the fifth grade teacher who ran the traffic boys, they were all part of his conspiracy. And it all seemed like this prim and proper and righteous stuff. The good guys, as they like to call themselves. But look at the vicious essence that came to the fore. They severely reprimanded this kid after they had traumatized him in this way, and they never apologized to him, as far as I know. When my turn came, even though that had disgusted me, I still wanted to be top sergeant because it was an honor. I won the popularity contest and got to be top sergeant, but it was very clear that the teacher who was in charge of the traffic boys, the principal and this cop all thought that I was not fit material for top sergeant. I was too much of a cut-up and too mischievous, too much of a kid who was always on the verge of being in trouble. They had to go along with the vote, but they were continually looking for ways to say I was messing up. In particular, I remember that year when I was top sergeant, my friend Ray, who was in the same grade with me and lived about a 5-minute walk from the school, found this stray puppy, which he named Mutt. He really fell in love with this puppy, and so did I, and we used to go every day after school and during lunchtime to play with Mutt, and then we'd come back before school started again. Because I was the top sergeant of the traffic boys, I had to leave class a little early and get all the traffic squads out, and then wait until about 10 after 12 when they all came back in and turned in their equipment, and then I ran up to Ray's house. We'd play with the puppy, and then I had to get back about 12:45 so I could get all the squads out. I did this day after day, and there were never any problems, until one time I was coming back from outside the school about 12:40, and the principal and the teacher who was in charge of the traffic boys saw me coming in. They demanded to know, "Where have you been?" I said, "I've been at my friend Ray's house." and they replied pretty much in unison, "What do you mean you've been at your friend Ray's house? You can't leave school during lunch hour." And I asked, "Why not?" They replied, "Because you're in charge of the traffic boys." I looked at them and said, "Yeah." And one of them came up with this, "Well, a captain doesn't leave his ship." And I came back with, "He does when it's docked at the harbor." That was my father's training in particular. They weren't going to get away with that one. They just had to shut up and walk off with a chagrined look. But the fact was that they really just didn't like me as a top sergeant. I liked Ike. I first started getting interested in the presidential elections and all that in 1952, when I was 9 years old. My parents were going to support Eisenhower that year instead of Stevenson. They usually voted for Democrats, but they decided to support Eisenhower, who had promised to go to Korea and end the Korean War. I remember that on occasion, after church service, usually the adults, mainly it was the men, but not only them, would stand around and talk about all these things going on in the world. This was especially the circle that my dad was most involved in at the church. And one time, I think it was the same year, 1952, I was listening to them talk about the Korean War and what do we do, and then at the end of the conversation, I came up with my plan for how to end the Korean War. They all turned and looked at me and said, "Oh, well, okay." So I remember starting to get really interested in those things at that time. I don't really remember my plan, although I'm sure it was totally unrealistic. By the time the Republican and then the Democratic conventions came around that year, my parents had quit supporting Eisenhower when Eisenhower refused to denounce and dissociate himself from McCarthy. But I was 9 years old, and they had already gotten me into supporting Eisenhower, so I stuck with Eisenhower, even though my parents went over to Stevenson. The Republican convention came on in 1 month, and then the Democratic convention the next month, and for those weeks I would not budge from the house. I was glued in front of the TV all day and all evening, watching those political conventions. You know, "Mr. Chairman, the great state of Ohio cast 27 votes for whomever." All this fascinated me. Now, usually during the summers when I was young, every day I would get up in the morning and leave the house by 9 o'clock, go down to my grammar school where there was a playground, and just stay down there all day, playing ball, mostly baseball. 6 days a week, I'd be down there just playing baseball, or sometimes football, all day long. My parents usually had to drive down there about 6 or 6:30 and pull me off the playground to come home and eat dinner. That was what I did. But during those political conventions, my friends would ring the doorbell. I'd come to the door, and the dialogue would go like this. Aren't you going to come down to the playground? No, I'm going to stay in. What are you doing? I'm watching television. What are you watching on television? I'm watching the Republican convention. The what? Then after that week was over, I went back to the playground the way I had before. But there was just something about the conventions that fascinated me. My parents would discuss the paper or the evening news when it was on television. Around these elections in 52 and again in 56, because I was still an Eisenhower supporter in 56, though as I remember, I didn't like Nixon even at that time. I used to read the newspaper when the campaigns were going on, the political conventions and stuff like that. I was fascinated with aspects of it, but I didn't really understand the issues very deeply, although I was beginning to think about things like the Korean War. I had a loyalty to Eisenhower that I developed, and I just stuck with it, you know. I couldn't give you then or now any kind of deep analysis of what I thought was good about Eisenhower. It was just that my parents had liked him, and even though they changed their mind because of McCarthy, and I became familiar with some of the issues bound up with McCarthyism, it wasn't enough to make me stop supporting Eisenhower. Have you no decency? I was recently watching Angels in America, where that phrase from the McCarthy hearings came up. At long last, sir, have you no decency? I watched a good part of the McCarthy hearings with my parents, and I actually saw that incident live, with McCarthy asking these questions the way he did, and Welch, the lawyer for this guy in the army, very dramatically saying, "At long last, sir, have you no decency?" My parents regarded McCarthyism as a witch hunt. I remember there was this black woman who was brought up before the McCarthy hearings, and they ruined her life. She wasn't even the person that they were supposedly going after. She just had a similar name. They hauled her before the committee and ruined her life, and they had the wrong person. leaving aside the fact that whenever they had the right person, it was just a witch hunt anyway. In my house and among the people I knew, to be a communist was a bad thing. But as we saw it then, McCarthy was falsely accusing a lot of people, ruining them and persecuting them, conducting witch hunts, spreading the net way too widely, and getting people to testify, even falsely, against other people in order to get out of trouble themselves. That was the whole thing that disturbed my parents and the circles that they were part of. And that's what I kind of picked up. McCarthy only really got into trouble when he started going after the people in the army. Then the powers that be joined ranks and said, no, no, you can't do that. And they pretty much put him down. Jumping ahead a few years to when I was in high school, Edward Teller's son was in one of my classes. That was the ugly side of Berkeley, because of the Livermore Lab and research to serve nuclear weapons development and that kind of thing. In grammar school, while I don't have a recollection of going around feeling scared all the time that a bomb was going to be dropped, I'm sure it had an effect on us kids psychologically, in a lot of ways, to be continually put through drills that were said to be part of preparing for a possible nuclear war. Still, I don't remember my childhood having a heavy mushroom cloud over it. The time that I do remember really feeling that, and I think everybody did, was the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But by then I was in college already. At that time I really thought the world was going to end, or that there was a good chance of it, and that fear was not unfounded. But I don't remember feeling that as a young kid, and in fact I think back of my childhood as being a time when there wasn't a lot of heavy weight like that. Even in Berkeley, though, the atmosphere was very heavily repressive, and any kind of protest didn't really break through until the late 50s. Even after McCarthy got slapped down, things were still pretty repressive. Not that you felt like your door was going to be kicked in by the secret police or something, but more like you didn't protest, you didn't step out of line, you didn't call attention to yourself in that kind of way. During that time, when I was in the last years of grammar school and the first years of junior high school, in the mid-1950s, there was also a lot of keeping up with the Joneses, all this consumerism that came off the victory of the U.S. in World War II. More generally, you didn't step out of line. You didn't get yourself branded. It was very repressive in that kind of way, for girls in particular. So I don't remember a lot of protests, even in Berkeley. There may have been some, I just don't remember. But I do remember a lot of debate about the Korean War, and there would be different occasions when I'd hear adults in particular debating social and political issues. Becoming aware of segregation. When I was about 9 years old or so, I began to become aware of segregation. Around that time, my parents got me a membership at the YMCA. The YMCA in Berkeley was very unusual, especially for that time, in that it was integrated. There were a number of black people, including kids who belonged to the Y. I went to Y camp for about 5 years, beginning when I was 9, and the main thing I remember about the camp is that it was integrated. Not only was the camp in general integrated, but we stayed in cabins, maybe a dozen kids, and the cabins were integrated. Each year the same kids would tend to come back, so there were about 3 or 4 black kids that were in the same cabin I was in, year after year. And yes, I had some conflicts with them. They thought, not without any justification, that I was sort of a spoiled, rich white kid from the Berkeley Hills. But I also learned a lot from them. I remember one time, for example, we were going on a hike. We were hiking up the side of a hill that seemed very steep and high at the time, though I'm sure it wasn't really. I got halfway up, and I got stuck. One of those situations where, if you try to go ahead, you can't get secure footing, and you can't go back. I was just stuck there. These 2 black kids, who I think were a year older than me, had already made it to the top. They came charging back down to save me, because it was clear I was stuck, and I was getting more and more freaked out. They did this even though they didn't really like me very much. I also remember one time I was homesick, and I knew some of these kids didn't like me, and I just broke down crying on my bunk. Well, one of these black kids came in and started talking to me and told me that I wasn't so bad after all, and comforted me. There were a lot of experiences like this pretty early in my childhood, and it's to my parents' credit that they had me join the Y in Berkeley and go to Y camp. It was a contradictory experience, because I was still coming from where I was coming from, and these kids picked up on that, and there was a lot of tension. But on the other hand, I learned a lot out of it, and not just in some academic sense. These experiences touched me and made a deep impression. so I was beginning to become aware of some larger social issues. As I was only 9 or 10 years old, I wasn't very deeply aware of these things, but I knew these black kids came from a different part of town than me, and that their lives were different from mine in many ways. Toward the end of the week, the camp would have these talent shows, and there was a kid, Fritz, who used to be able to do this thing they called the ham bone, where he would slap his thighs and then his chest, pop his mouth, and make noise with it. He was really good at it. I've seen adults do it, and maybe it's my distortion from being a 9 or 10-year-old, but I don't remember seeing anybody do it as well as Fritz. Fritz absolutely owned the camp because he was so good at this. All week long, he was never short of candy bars or whatever goodies there were in the camp, and other kids were making his bed for him because they'd say, "Fritz, do the ham bone," and he'd answer, "Oh, well, I don't know," and they'd keep going, "Come on, Fritz, I'll make your bed for you." It was that kind of thing. I'm sure there was racism at the YMCA camp, but on the surface and in their principles, the camp wasn't run on a segregated basis. They made a point of that. They had some counselors who were black. They had a lot of staff who were black, though I don't think there were as many black counselors as staff. Some of the high school kids who were paid staff would also come out and play ping pong or tetherball or stuff like that. You got to see some of these black guys who were a little older, and they had a little different perspective, so you learned. I remember one guy, I think his name was James, who was about 17 and worked in the kitchen staff. All the kids really loved it when he came out and played tetherball with us, because he was a really nice guy, but he was also hilarious. He'd stand by the tetherball and say, "Okay, you ready?" as if he were going to go one direction. Then he hit the ball in the other direction. He'd let you hit the ball for a while, like you're almost going to wrap it around the pole, and then he'd grab the pole and start shaking it so you couldn't hit it. And I remember being really endeared to someone like that, like an older brother. But while there wasn't a lot of overt segregation, I'm sure if I'd been a little older and talked to those guys like James, they could have told me a lot of stories. But I didn't perceive a lot of it, because what I was aware of, not only things like the dining hall, but the cabins, were integrated. The people who ran the camp were consciously trying to do something against segregation. The way I lived in the regular school year was segregated, so you didn't notice the segregation as much, if you were white. However, once again, because of sports, from about the fourth grade, we'd play basketball, football, and baseball against other grammar schools in the city. We went to West Berkeley and South Berkeley and played against the black kids who went to schools like Columbus, Washington, and Lincoln. I remember one guy named Earl who played basketball for Washington. He was about 10 years old and really a great dribbler. I used to pride myself on being able to really dribble the ball well, so there was very intense competition between us when we played Washington. When you go to these schools to play against these kids, you see this school was not the quality of your school, and the playground was not of the quality of your playground. And you could see signs that the lives of the kids were harder. But it was only later that I put some of these things together more consciously. I remember my parents talking about discrimination from the time I was very young. They were opposed to segregation in housing and in the schools. It didn't depend on my asking them. They were already talking about this. So I was aware of these things. But it was like snippets, what I'd hear from them, what I'd see when I'd go to play a basketball game at one of those schools in West Berkeley or South Berkeley, or one of the kids would come up to your playground, and maybe you'd talk to him a little bit. Or you'd go to Y Camp, and you'd get some sense of people's lives from when you'd sit around and talk at night by the campfire or back in your cabin. The things that the kids from West and South Berkeley would talk about were often very different. In some ways, they were the same. Kids do a lot of the same things. But in some ways, they were very different in their experiences and how they saw certain things. But what I was learning was in pieces. Our family would have dinner table conversations where we talk about segregation and how it was wrong. The neighborhoods we lived in and the school we went to were virtually all white. But at the same time, it's not like my parents wanted it to remain that way. And it's not just that they talked about it. They became involved and very active in things like the Fair Housing Act and desegregating the schools. At that time, the public schools in Berkeley were very segregated, until you got to Berkeley High. This was one of the great things about it. There was only one high school. At one point, there was talk about splitting the city and having two high schools. I remember all my friends in high school and I were very vehemently opposed to this, for two reasons. One, and I will say it was the main thing, we knew it was a move to segregate the high schools. And two, it would undermine the strength of our sports teams. On the first ground mainly, but also on the second ground, we were vehemently opposed to this. But there was, of course, even in Berkeley, plenty of racism. When I went to junior high school, I think there were about 25 black kids, and there were some Mexicans and Chicanos and some Asians, but it was overwhelmingly white. Still, everybody knew we were going to Berkeley High, which was essentially half black. There were three junior highs at the time. The one I went to, Garfield, was mainly white. Another, Willard, was about half black, and the other junior high, Burbank, was overwhelmingly black with some Latino and Asian students and a very few white kids, mainly working class. We interacted with them in sports and in other school programs, and the anticipation of going to Berkeley High was a big deal. Everybody talked about what it was going to mean when you went to Berkeley High. There were a lot of episodes and incidents where things would break out between the different junior high schools, or they'd have programs where the ninth graders would all go to the high school for a one-day orientation to get them ready for next year, and there would almost always be a fight. Everybody would be talking about it. A lot of racist shit came out, especially in that context. Among the boys, it was often put in terms of, how are you going to fight with the niggers when you went to Berkeley High? There was a lot of that kind of talk. Not so much among my circle of friends, but more broadly, there was a lot of that. Family vacations. I also loved to travel when I was a kid. When I was three, when we moved to Berkeley, we took a long car ride across the country, and I liked that a lot. Then when I was around 11, we were visiting relatives in Fresno, staying with my grandmother. My grandfather had died a little while before that. And at the end of the trip, even though we'd driven down in a family car, I really wanted to take the train back, because I love riding on trains. I guess my parents waited and decided I was old enough, because they let me take the train back. But they made a point of talking to the conductor and some of the other people who worked on the train and asked them to keep an eye on me. It was interesting. There was this kid whose father was a porter on the train, this black kid named Lynn, and we struck up a friendship during the train ride. We ran all up and down the train causing havoc, and he got free food because his father worked on the train. It was just a natural thing that kids do. We were about the same age. We were traveling on the train. We struck up a conversation, and pretty soon we were running all up and down the train having all kinds of fun. Then the train pulled into Berkeley, and my parents were there. That was a big deal to me, to be able to ride on the train, and the whole experience. When I was around 9, we went in the summer to Ensenada in Mexico and spent a week or two there at a hotel on the beach. There was this kid named Francisco who lived in the town but used to come down to the beach every day and play, so he and I struck up a friendship. I didn't speak any Spanish at the time, except maybe for a few words. But somehow we managed. He spoke a little English, and he taught me a few Spanish words. And by the end of the vacation, we'd become really good friends. I would go down to the beach and wait every day for him to come, and he would show up every day. I don't know what we did for the whole day. We just hung out together. The water was warm, and you could go way, way out. It was great for kids. You could go something like a quarter mile out and would still only be up a little over your waist. So we'd swim and come back and build sandcastles and just manage to communicate whatever way we did. Another time we took a trip to Reno. My dad was doing some work there, and we got put up in the hotel owned by his client. We got these seats for the show in the main restaurant theater of the hotel, right down on the front. Really great seats. The show wasn't that much, but there was this comedian, and it was like a typical nightclub act. He told these jokes that were really more appropriate for adults, but I laughed anyway. Some of them I understood, some of them I didn't. I used to love to chew a whole bunch of pieces of gum all at the same time. By the time this guy came on to do his act, I think I had something like 10 pieces of gum going in my mouth at the time. Then he got to this part in his act when he was going to do this ventriloquist routine. So he looks around and he says, "Let me get a volunteer to come up here and be the dummy to sit on my lap." Since I was the only kid there, he says, you come on up." So I go on up there and he says, "What's your name?" And I answered, "Bobby." He asked, "How old are you?" And I dutifully replied, 9. He asked me some more questions of that type. "Do you go to school?" "Yes." "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I thought for a while, and then I said, "I want to be a basketball player like Bob Matheny, who played for Cal at that time." He came back, "Don't you want to be a comedian like me?" I was actually taking this all seriously, so I stopped for a minute and reflected and then said, "No." And the whole crowd just cracked up. Then he got down to business. "Okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do now. Meanwhile, my mom is furiously signaling me from our table right in front to take my gum out of my mouth. So I take the gum out of my mouth, but there's nowhere to put it. I'm looking around desperately for a place to put it while he's talking to me, but I can't find any place, so I stick it in my pants pocket. Then he says, "Okay now, you're going to sit on my knee, and when I squeeze the back of your neck, just chomp real hard on your gum, and it'll look like you're talking." When he said, "Chomp real hard on your gum," I realized I didn't have my gum in my mouth anymore, so I reached down into my pocket to get the gum out, and of course there's this big wad of gum that's stuck to my pocket. I'm pulling at it, but it's stuck to my pocket, and I can't get it out, and everybody's just cracking up. Finally, I get the gum freed from my pocket, and I stick it back in my mouth. He does this whole routine. Whenever he squeezes on my neck, I chomp on my gum. Then when we finish, he runs off the stage, and I run off behind him. He comes back on the stage and takes a bow, and I come back and take a bow. Then I go back to my seat. The next day we were skiing, and I could see these two women were looking at me. They kept eyeing me, and I looked around, wondering if I'd done something wrong. Finally, one of them came up to me and asked, "Is your name Bobby?" I said, "Yeah." Then she asked if I were at the show at the hotel last night, and I answered, "Yeah," again. She said, "You weren't really just a kid in the audience. You're actually part of the show regularly, right?" And I said, no, I'm not." "Oh," she explained, "I bet my friend that you were really part of the show regularly." The movies. I really didn't do that much reading outside of school until I got to high school. Before that, I read things like the Hardy Boys mysteries and some sports fiction, and sometimes I read the Collier's encyclopedias we had in the house. But I went to the movies all the time as a kid. There used to be a theater in Berkeley where they had kids' movies on Saturday afternoons, and it would always be double features. I would often go to those, especially when the weather wasn't so good. You could sit there for hours. I didn't care where in the movie I went in. The movie could be two-thirds over, and I'd go in and watch the end of that movie. Then I'd stay through the next movie, and I'd stay through the first movie again until it got back to the point where I came in. These were typical kids' action movies, a lot of westerns. One of the movies that made an impression on me when I was maybe 13 was this movie about Cochise. That movie made a big impression on me at that time because it presented Indians in a very different way than the whole cowboys and Indians stereotype that was all over the TV and movies. Even though looking back on it now, what this movie showed Cochise doing was actually conciliating with the white expansionists, what struck me then was that it presented Cochise as a dignified person who wasn't just doing all this really crude stereotypical stuff they had the Indians doing in the average cowboy and Indian movies. The baseball hat. There was always stuff I had to have. Nothing really fancy, just toys, sports equipment, stuff like that. And when I got a little older, I'd sometimes want clothes. There'd be certain kinds of clothes you had to have if you were cool. Like when I was in junior high school, it was really cool to have a Pendleton shirt. So I had to save up money to get a Pendleton. I think my parents went in half with me. If I did a few odd jobs and saved money, they'd pay for half of the Pendleton shirt, and I'd pay for the other half. One time my mother gave me a baseball hat. When I was a younger kid, they didn't have any major league teams yet in the Bay Area. They came when I was in high school. The Dodgers and the Giants came to L.A. and San Francisco. But in the Bay Area, they had minor league AAA baseball teams. AAA was the rung just below the major leagues. They had the Oakland A's, short for Acorns, and the San Francisco Seals. I used to go to Oakland A's baseball games all the time. If you were a kid and you sat way out in the bleachers in center field, where you could hardly see anything, you could get in for 9 cents in those days. So I used to go and sit in the 9 cent seats on Saturday a lot, and more often during the summer months. I'd go with my parents, or sometimes just with my friends. I was a big Oakland A's fan. One year for Christmas, my mom gave me a baseball hat, but she got confused and gave me a baseball hat for the San Francisco Seals, which was a big rival of the Oakland A's. So I traded that hat with one of my relatives or friends for something else. And then a day or so later, my dad came and told me, "You know, your mom is really upset because you traded away the present she gave you." I said, "But it's the wrong team. It's the Seals, not the Oakland A's." And I'll never forget his response. "Yeah, but she put a lot of thought into buying you this hat, and she's pretty upset and kind of heartbroken that you traded it away." So I went and got it back. And since that time, I have never, ever traded away a present because it tore me up that my mother was so upset. When I traded it, I didn't think of how she felt. I was just thinking, it's the wrong team. I'll trade it for something else I'd rather have. But my mom didn't get hurt that often or that easily, so it made a big impression on me when my dad told me how upset she was. Not only did I get that present back, but after that, whether I liked the present or not, if someone got me a present, I kept it, because the whole incident with my mother was strongly, indelibly burned into my consciousness. I learned to see things more from someone else's perspective, to think more about their feelings. Berkeley and all, I was still pretty typical of the mainstream middle class in my outlook during my childhood. In high school, I became more socially and politically conscious. A lot of things were breaking out in the open much more. The civil rights movement, things in the intellectual sphere, civil liberties things. In high school, I was very much conscious of that and proud of being from Berkeley, the sort of place that wasn't typical. But not in grammar school or even in the first years of junior high. Really, insofar as I thought about it, I probably just thought of myself as an American, and very lucky and privileged to be one.